Morning. Well, our second time of doing this in two sessions. First session and second session. The early birds and the sloths. Or whatever. That's a negative connotation, but not for me. Not for me. So today I'm going to talk about the first of the five hindrances in Buddhism. A little intro first. The five hindrances. Desire, aversion, sloth, and torpor. Speaking about sloth. Restlessness and doubt. Difficult energies which arise in the mind and in life. Difficult energies. Not negative, because we all have them. Just difficult energies. Not only do we all have them, if you look at ancient meditative traditions, you see them popping up in all of them. The Christian desert father teacher Evagrius in Egypt in the 2nd century AD talked about demons. Demons, when you go out to be a desert meditator in the 2nd century AD, he talks about demon of desire. Wanting to go back. You're out in the desert and you think, geez, this is hard. I want to go back to town. Gee, this is hard. I want to go back to bed. It's Sunday morning. What do I do here? Demons. Aversion. Too hot or too cold out there in the desert. Either it's too cold at night or it's too hot in the daytime. Too hot or too cold to come to Zen Center or do the meditation. I just got back from a very warm place. It's too cold here this morning. Hey. Sloth and torpor. We do a pretty good job in our meditation. We're pretty concentrated. We get rid of our desire, at least hold it in advance so it's not freaking us out too much. We get rid of our aversion. And then what happens? We fall asleep. We don't have anything to grab onto, anything to get all charged up about, or anything to push away. We fall asleep. That happened to anybody? Maybe you're not advanced enough. Restlessness. Sitting here looking at a wall or looking at the back of someone's head when you could be at home just vegging out on Sunday. Isn't that what Sundays are for, to veg out? But here you are, just restless, your mind a twitter all over the place for 30 minutes or however long. Restlessness. What do you think it was like for those desert fathers once they left everything? They just said, oh, I'm going to be in the desert for 2 years, and then they got really restless. Same. And then the last one, the demon of doubting the whole thing. Doubting the whole enterprise. Because these first four are always coming up and getting us. So after a while we think, is this meditation really for me? And it might be for Tim. He seems to be able to calm his mind down. But my mind doesn't come down. I don't think it's for me. Doubt. Doubt, right? Doubt. Big time. So it doesn't matter if it's a Buddhist tradition or ancient India or China or the Desert Fathers. It's the same. It's the same. The same impediments. The same hindrances. And in Buddhist mythology, they talk about the poison tree. The tree which is full of poison. And how you deal with the tree that has all those different poisons in it. Well, what we want to do is chop it down and get rid of it, right? Chop it down and get rid of it. But that's violent. That's violent. We're doing harm to ourselves. We all have desire. We all have doubt. Everybody dislikes some things. That's doing violence to ourselves to cut the tree down. I think we should cut it down. That's cutting ourselves down. It's cutting ourselves down. So then the second thing you can do, according to this Buddhist mythology, the next best thing, the first one is the worst thing you can do. The next worst thing is to put up a sign near the tree that says, "This is a poison tree. Don't eat the berries, don't eat the leaves." This is a poison tree. Don't eat the berries, don't eat the leaves. And instead of killing it, you can take shade in it rather than freak out. And we do that when we're sitting. We're restraining our desire. We're restraining our aversion. We're restraining our doubt to be a successful meditator. It's impossible without some restraint to get along in the world, get along on the cushion, and get along with our family members, get along with our people we care about. So that's the middle one, but the best one of all. Some of you remember this because I talked about it before, probably even in one of my books. Oh, a poison tree, just what I've been looking for. These berries make the best medicine for curing a number of illnesses, including the illness of desire, aversion, sloth, restlessness, and doubt. I'll take the very energies that are difficult and work with them. Distill them in my own body, in my own heart, my own consciousness, until, as medicine, they have a curative effect. A curative effect. It takes a while for medicine to work, especially this kind of medicine. But they do. They have a curative effect. So we don't get rid of them. We can't get rid of them anyway, so we can fake that we've gotten rid of them for a while. Right? if you're well acculturated, if you're brought up in the right religious tradition, you're pretty good at that, right? So every mind, desires, hates certain things, gets exhausted, wants to veg out like a sloth. After I do my thing here today, I'll go home and veg out like a sloth. I'll lie on the couch, and I won't say all the things that I'll do that are sloth-like, but, you know, a sloth doesn't have to do much of all. That's one thing that's fun about being a sloth. No problem. Every mind hates, every mind doubts. So with that intro, now I want to talk about the first one, desire. Desire. Physical desire. We all have physical desire for food, comfort, sex. And we all have psychological desire. We want to feel connected. We want to feel not separate and isolated. So we're doing these two talks on Sundays now. Part of the reason we decided to do this was that I heard from a lot of people the last year that it's too crowded during tea, that they feel at ease. I mean, ill at ease, socially ill at ease. It's like a cocktail party. They just want to get out. Socially ill at ease. They can't make friends. They can't bond. So now we're doing this two talks, and I heard from a lot of people, oh no, I'm not going to see my friends. They're going to be going to the 10, the 11 one, and I'm going to go to the 9 one. How do I know? If they're at the 9 and I'm at the 11, what do I know? But we have a strong affiliative tendency, don't we? Strong. We all need friends. And you know, when you think about religious communities in the United States, friendship, collegiality, extended family. Think about the Christian religious tradition, the Judaic religion tradition. Oh, so that's what its main component of is. Camaraderie. So we all have psychological desires, and sometimes we can laugh at them, which I'll talk about in a minute. We have healthy desires, we have unhealthy desires, and we have desires that we get stuck on. Some are healthy and we still get stuck on them, and some are unhealthy and we get more stuck on them. Fixated on them. So when I was a young man, I started practicing meditation with a Japanese Zen teacher named Suzuki Roshi. And I lived at a place called Tassajara in California. I lived there for a few months. And we had a desire to, back then, just like you do, to discover a deep calmness within ourselves and manifest that calmness. And we had one teacher. And there weren't any other Buddhist teachers around then. We just had him. We couldn't go shopping. You can go shopping here in Minnesota. You just have to go from one part of the town to another part of the town to another part of the town. We couldn't go shopping. We either had him or that was it. That was it. But he was wonderful, and so that was cool. And our desire was to be like him. No. To have the same kind of quietness and openness and compassion and joy that we saw in him. At least we thought we saw. I don't know if that was probably our projection. I know it was partly our projection, but it was also there. So, he dressed in black. A number of us started dressing in black. There were no priests then, you know. No priests. But the teacher's dressing in black, so all the students start dressing in black because they have a deep desire to be like him and to emanate. And then he had a shaved head, so my friends started shaving their heads. Pretty soon, half the people at Tassajara, not very many women back then, I don't think any women, not back then. This was more than 50 years ago before it was chic to have a bald head. You know, you may not think it's chic now, but. And then, the next thing is that people started making his grammatical mistakes. It's true. They started making his grammatical mistakes. Well, the desire is a little out of whack then, isn't it? The desire is getting a little out of whack. They're really stuck on that desire to be like him. Really stuck on it. We were in the counterculture, you know, and we had rejected our own parents' values, our own parents' way of being. Our teacher, what do they know? I mean, our academic teacher, but a Zen teacher. Oh. A little out of whack. So we might reach out time and time again to our lover, to our friend, to our teacher, wanting a special relationship. The key is to mindfully see it. That's the key. Not to cut it off. To mindfully see it. You have some desire that you're stuck on. Any desire. And you study it. Not intellectual study. You study it more closely than intellectual study. More closely. To study the way, as Dogen said, is to study the self. You study it. Not saying, oh, I shouldn't have it. I should get rid of it after practicing so long. I won't have this anymore. Good luck. Good luck. Study it. Study it. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. All desires do. They have beginnings, they have middle, they have ends. So I was just in a warm place. I'm not going to say where. I was just in a warm place, and my daughter and her family came to visit us in this warm place. And when my daughter left, she left in the refrigerator. I don't know how she happened to leave it. Two large 90% chocolate bars. 90%. That's 90% chocolate and only 10% sugar. You know those large bars that are 90%? Well, those are, quote, healthy, unquote, because they only have 10% sugar, right? And so I just opened the refrigerator, and I said to Linda, oh, look what Aaron left. And she said, yes, because she knows. Linda knows about me and chocolate. But I did my practice, not so much in a self-conscious way, but just did it. Instead of just immediately going for the chocolate, I watched. I noticed the desire in my body. I noticed starting to salivate. You can actually notice this, you know. If you slow down, you can notice it. I had paid attention to imagining the satisfaction when I just had one square, which was what I was going to have. It's just one square. And I paid attention to all that. Then I really looked at the chocolate, looked at the craving, felt the tension and the pain. When there's craving, there's tension and pain. We want to, even just for chocolate, we want to alleviate it, right? I put it in my mouth, and the tension and the pain softens. It relaxes. It touches my tongue. It melts in my mouth. It tastes delicious. It's really good. Great happiness. But it's not just the pleasure. It's also partly because the desire ends. Desire ends. But then I see another one ad infinitum. Pretty soon it's gone. But we won't go that far. Actually, I did not go that far. So the same with negative emotions, which are all emanating from desire or thwarted desire or unconscious desire. Discover when that anger, when that confusion, when that hatred, when that sadness begins. Oh, here it comes up. Sustains itself, what we say, what we do to sustain it, and how it ends. Study it. Study it. You can learn a lot about yourself and about other people, because other people are exactly like we are. Exactly. William Blake says, if one is to do good, it must be done in the minute particulars. General good is the plea of the hypocrite, the scoundrel, and the flatterer. So one emotion at a time, one piece of chocolate at a time. Our ideal, I'll get rid of this. That's a violent ideal. Actually perpetuating that ideal causes violence to yourself. Study how you actually relate to your family, to your loved ones, to the people nearest to you, to the people in this room. Study it. What emotion comes up? If a little anger comes up, notice the triggers. And notice how you fuel the fire with your thinking, with your talking to yourself. Notice how it tapers off. So, I'm a first child, and I was a CEO for years, so I'm used to being right. I expect to be right. I expect people to treat me as if I were right. I've been expecting that till my mother started, you know, fawning over me when I was 5 years old. So I have a desire to be right. I love to be right. It feels so good to be right. And I have been guiding teacher here for 16 years. So I've been right, able to be right. I've been the man, so to speak. And now I'm going to pick on Ted again. Sorry, Ted, maybe I won't do this too many more times. Now I have a co-guiding teacher. All of a sudden, it's January 1, and I have a co-guiding teacher. What's the deal here? I'm the one who's right. But now he's the co-guiding teacher. He challenges me about something. That's his job, to challenge me sometimes. We're co. Oh, can I pay attention to his voice? Can I stop, look, and listen when he challenges me? Can I feel the quality of my desire to be right and to tell him what's really the way things are and my resistance to his idea of what's right? Can I just be with that? Just be with that? What it's like in my body, what it does in that moment to my relationship with him, what it does in that moment to my relationship with him. Rather than trying to get rid of it, just be with it. Just be with it. And what's the sense of self, the sense of Tim that's built around that story I tell myself? Can I be with all that? I think so. That's our practice, isn't it? That's our practice. Can I relate to desire in a friendly way? In a compassionate way, with a little bit of wisdom rather than beating myself up. So, in our practice, the focus, when it's not on the object of desire, that's best. Not on the object, but the feeling, including the pain or the fear that evokes the desire. This takes courage. Our practice takes courage. It takes persistence. It takes persistence. We really need to do a regular meditation practice to do. If we do an irregular, it's hard to really do this practice. Even with a regular meditation practice, it's not that easy. But little by little, it transforms our relationships to others and to ourselves. So we're not violent with ourselves anymore. Now, you may think violence too strong a word, but think about all the nasty things you say to yourself. If that's not violence, what is? Really, think about all the nasty things you say to yourself. That's violence. So notice that. Notice that. Notice that. Not trying to get rid of it, but just notice it with some softness, with your heart. Give yourself the same kind of break that you would give your favorite puppy or something who's not house trained. Give yourself that much latitude. So before I began meditation, I got thrown off by desire all the time. Well, still I get thrown off sometimes, but then I got thrown off all the time. So, the story that I have not told for maybe 4 or 5 years, when I first met my teacher, I had a spontaneous enlightenment experience. And I was all for telling him about it. I had a desire to tell someone because I knew I couldn't tell my father. He'd think I was crazy. He thought I was crazy already. And my friends thought I was weird. I did try telling them. I thought, oh, a Zen teacher. Tell him about it. He'll endorse me. I had a great desire to get the affirmation from a Zen teacher, a real Zen teacher. The real deal. So I told him about my, so I won't, it's already almost 30 minutes. I won't get into much into this. So anyway, I met him. And I was in his office and I told him about it, my experience. And he said, oh, that's good, but that's not Zen. Oh, I'm not Zen. I didn't know how to practice with desire in those days. I was just confused and angry. Confused and angry. And then I thought, well, he doesn't understand English anyway. So I carried that wound with me for a long time because I hadn't learned how to practice with desire. In contrast to someone who's been practicing with desire for a long time, like the Dalai Lama. Huh. That guy has been practicing with desire for a long time, right? What age did he start practicing? 8 or something? Right? Practicing with desire. So here's the Dalai Lama speaking at Gethsemane Monastery. He's speaking at Gethsemane Monastery before a large group, formal group, and he says, I've just been given a piece of cheese, but I really want a cake. And he burst out laughing. that guy's been practicing with the desire for a while, right? That's how he starts off his talk. So can we experience the feeling that lies behind our desire? And notice that it actually loses its power over us? It really does. If we do it non-judgmentally, with an open heart, and we can guffaw along with the Dalai Lama. That's some desire that comes up. So in Indian Buddhism, prior to Zen, there were 6 levels of smiling and laughter. 6 levels. And the most advanced level in Indian Buddhism was the Buddha smile. The Buddha smile is a faint smile. Composed, calm, restrained, an inner attitude of detachment. All the Indian Buddhas, many of them, you see this, the Indian Buddhas. And that is considered the most advanced practice in Indian Buddhism. Shita, S-I-T-A, the most advanced. And then you go down, and then there's the most primitive, the most vulgar, which is Zen. Which is Zen. Uproarious laughter, accompanied by doubling over. You don't have to double over. So the Dalai Lama was a Zen guy and didn't even know it. Through mindful studying, we can learn how to do belly laughs. They come naturally. Hote, Futai, Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, belly laughs. In China, there was a guy named, a student named Shui Lao, whose master, after he'd been sitting with his master for years in a one-to-one, the master poked him in the chest. And then he says, ever since the master poked me in the chest, I have been unable to stop laughing. So that's one thing we can do. Laugh at our desires. Just laugh at them. They are pretty funny, aren't they? They really are. Imagine the Dalai Lama. He looks at it. It looks kind of cake-like. And he picks it up, and it's a piece of cheese. Funny, right? Funny. And there are a couple other things we can do, since my time is ending. A couple other things we can do. If the desire is appropriate, but we are clinging to the desire, we can focus on impermanence. Whatever. Just as you and I were talking about, impermanence. Every desire is impermanent. The reason I have a co-guiding teacher is that I'm impermanent. I'm practicing whether I like it or not. Gyate, gyate. Gone, gone. My body's starting to go. My mind's starting to go. My memory's starting to go. Well, my memory's always been half gone, so. Gyate, gyate. Everything's impermanent. So there's a desire that comes up. We're clinging to it. Just notice that it ebbs and flows, that everything ebbs and flows. And if the desire is something that's harmful to us, we can focus on the consequences of getting what we want. If that chocolate bar that was left in the refrigerator had been only 40% chocolate and 60% sugar, I would have immediately closed the door, because I have Lyme disease and I'm not supposed to have that kind of sugar. So I know about the consequences. I know about the consequences. And we learn about the consequences, then we have to remind ourselves. That's good. That's good. Good. So the historical Buddha supposedly talked to his son Rahula about desire. And he said to Rahula, if your desires will lead to harming yourself or others, you shouldn't act on them. If, on the other hand, you see no harmful consequences from your actions, take joy in your progress on the path and use that joy to nourish your continued practice. So we can ask ourselves, is this a healthy desire? Yeah, is it healthy? And if it's healthy, good, good. We can ask ourselves, is this something I really want? Do I really want this? And we can ask ourselves, what really matters to me? If I only had another month or another 6 months to live, what desires really matter to me? What really matter to me? At this time in my life, I have two, when I ask myself this, at this time in my life, I have two big desires that I think are healthy. If I get fixated on them, they're not healthy. But one is to hang out with my grandkids. I got two, and I try to hang out with them whenever possible. My great pleasure. And the second is to hang out with you guys, to try to help you settle into this deep quietness that's here. Settle into it so that you feel okay. You feel better than okay in your life, in interpersonally or in inside yourselves. That's my great desire, my great pleasure and great desire. So I have two desires, grandkids and you guys. It's a little bit different. My grandkids are not interested in the Dharma. I don't know. They don't look like they're going that way to me. Well, maybe, who knows? Maybe they will. Maybe they will. So that's what I want to say this morning. And let's see. I think we have on this new schedule, we've got 15 more minutes, including announcements. Is that right? We have till 9:50? So, is that right, Margie?
Yeah, let me double check.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay, so questions or comments? Yeah. Yaniv.
I was wondering about this.
You have to talk loud.
I was wondering about this scene that you described where you go to your teacher and you had this experience of connection, and what he offers you is essentially rejection.
Well, I felt like he was rejecting me, but I don't think he was rejecting me. I think what he was, I was attached to the memory that I, of an experience I'd had. And I think that he saw my attachment to the memory and instead wanted to teach me meditation. So what he did was he said, that's good, but it's not Zen. And then he took me into the meditation hall and had me sit with him on a black cushion. Because I think he sensed that I was fixated on this and I wanted to be endorsed for something good that I had done. That's what I think. I can never be sure. I can never be sure.
But if you came out of that interaction hurt.
Yeah, I did.
It couldn't have been enlightened action on part of your teacher.
Well, I don't, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it wasn't. It's still this. Maybe it was. Maybe it, well, I did stay with him though, you know. So I did stay with him. And then later I started thinking, well, was I trying to just kind of show off to him? And I thought, well, in a way I was trying to show off. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not saying that, I'm not talking about his action being enlightened. I'm talking about how I was stuck on my desire. That's what I'm talking about. But I do think his action was enlightened. But I can't say for sure. I can't say. I think, you know, any positive experience we have in the past that we're caught on creates a film. Even it's like a great enlightenment experience. You should stay away from people who are talking a lot about their great enlightenment experiences because they're real attached to them, big time. Right? That's what I think. Oh, but that's a good question. That's a good question, Yanif. Yeah. Yeah, Bernie.
Did he also tell you to take care of your shoes?
Oh, do you want me to tell that story?
Is it the same story?
No, much later.
Oh.
That's just after I've been that's much. This was before I'd been practicing with him. That was much later. So I had another experience with him. Well, another enlightenment experience I had much later in the middle of a retreat. A huge opening and just, Tim just fell away completely and I just felt love for all life. And then the next day he talked to me about it and just said something and then three or four days later, we had a down day at Tassajara where we didn't have to do all the sitting and all the chanting and all the work. And I told him I was going to go for. He asked me what I was going to do. I don't know. I said I was going to go for a hike. And so then I went for a hike. And then when I went for a hike, I left my shoes. And by his room, my sandals, but they were all higgledy-piggledy and they had mud on them. And then when I came back, he said, well, now that you've attained so-called enlightenment, and he emphasized the so-called, it's time to take care of those. that's that story. That's a story a few years later. But actually a similar story in a way. Yeah. Other folks. Yeah, Maggie. Pardon? What?
How do you determine what a healthy desire is versus an...
Well, how do you determine it, Maggie? How do you try to parse it out for yourself?
I have a hard time with that.
Uh-huh.
Because I feel that sometimes I'm asking for reality to be different from what it is, and that seems inherently unhealthy.
Sometimes you're what?
I'm asking for reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, usually if you're asking for reality to be different than it is, that's not a very healthy desire. If you're framing it that way, it's not a healthy desire. Now, if you think about it differently, I would like, I only get to see my grandkids 4 times a year. And if I start complaining or groaning about, geez, I wanted to see them more, maybe I should buy them a ticket to come here. Oh, their mother doesn't want them to come here from this far. And then the desire becomes unhealthy. But I get to see them four times a year. That's my healthy desire. And it would be wonderful I could see them more. But as soon as I start ruminating and strategizing to try to get more time with them, I get caught. And the desire becomes unhealthy. Not always. Maybe I can talk to my daughter and say, well, Aaron, you know, da-da-da-da-da, maybe we could try the boys staying another week. And she, oh, yeah, well, that's healthy. Right? I think we each have to just parse it out for ourselves. Yeah.
What if you believe someone close to you has unhealthy values and desires, so you desire to change them?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, so what if you believe that someone has unhealthy desires and they're not doing them good, they're not doing your good, they're souring everything? That's a difficult situation, isn't it? It's a difficult situation. It depends on how toxic they are. If they're not too toxic, you just have to be with them. You just have to be with them. Giving advice, we were just talking about this, giving advice is kind of the last option. People, think about all the times you've gotten advice that it's made you, that it's pissed you off. You didn't really want advice. You wanted empathy. You wanted to be listened to. So, if the person is so toxic that you have to stay away from them because of their unhealthy desires, that's one thing. But if you're going to be a bodhisattva, you try to be there with them. You try to listen to them. You try to open to them. So that maybe they will ask for support, and then you can give them support. Unsolicited advice is, in 9 times out of 10, is just not good for a relationship. It's just not. And I'm saying this as a man who was trained to be right, that I was always right. So, you know, I was trained that I was always right, but my wife, over more than 50 years, has done a great job of untraining me. Really, she's done a great job of untraining me. My wife and my Zafu untrained me together. How is that?
With Ben on Saturday, February 2nd. There's going to be a movie night coming up on Friday, February 1st. There will be delicious treats, good conversation, and the film I Heart Huckabees. We'll be watching that and having a discussion together. If you think you might like to help that night, there's a volunteer sign-up sheet out front. Anne. Anne's going to say a little something about juicing.
Yes. Morning. The second part of the change that we undertook for the new year is the Tuesday night sit and talk here. We are the speaker. We used to do, on the old way, Tim would come back on Tuesday night and give the talk. But now, those of us who are priests in training are giving the talks on Tuesday nights. Last week, Matt kicked it off with a really wonderful talk about Donna that had nothing to do with money. actually, during tea, I overheard accidentally someone say how great it was to hear a new voice. No offense to the familiar. And this Tuesday, my pal Bill Loywood will talk about Scylla, or morality ethics. So we would love to have you there in your invited.
Thank you.
What time does that talk start in?
I don't know.
Okay.
7:30.
And there's 2 20-minute sits.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Ann. Tim, would you say a little something about your blog?
Oh, yes. Well, she just said a little something about my blog. I have a blog that used to be Huffington Post used to do my blog, but then about a year ago they quit doing it. So I've kept doing it on my own here at Zen Center.